Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Okay, let's start this deep dive thinking about something pretty stark. The difference between a life measured in months, maybe a year or two, and a life that could stretch into decades. It sounds dramatic, but that entire spectrum can sometimes hinge on just how well a single protein is working, or how much function is left in it. We're talking about the insulin receptor, or INSR.
Right.
If someone has, say, genetic changes that cause an almost complete loss of that receptor's function, well, that leads to Donahue syndrome. And tragically, that's usually fatal very early in life, often in infancy.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the part that's kind of mind-blowing. If you manage to hold on to just maybe 10 or 20% of that receptor's normal function, you might survive much longer, potentially into adulthood, though with a condition called Rabson-Mendenhall syndrome.
It's an incredibly steep relationship, isn't it? That function versus life expectancy curve.
Exactly.
That small window, that residual activity, it's everything.
Yeah.
And it really highlights something clinically important. For a patient whose receptor is, you know, severely compromised, if we could find any way to nudge that activity up, even just a tiny bit,
yeah,
that could be the difference. It could offer a decisive, maybe even life-saving clinical benefit.
But there's a major hurdle right at the start, a genetic one. Mm-hmm. When doctors sequence the INSR gene in patients with these severe syndromes, they very often find new changes,
yeah,
variations they haven't seen before.
Variants of uncertain significance. VUS.
Right, the VUS problem. They know the gene's involved, they know it's likely broken, but they can't tell how broken that specific variant makes the receptor. Is it 5% function, 15%? They just don't know.
And that uncertainty is a huge roadblock.
Mm-hmm.
If you can't accurately gauge the severity of the defect from the gene sequence alone, well, designing a targeted therapy becomes incredibly difficult. Forget precision medicine, you're kind of stuck.
So the work we're looking at today tackled this head-on with a really ambitious approach, almost an industrial scale, you could say.
Mm.
This team set out to measure the function of nearly every single possible amino acid change in the critical outer part of the receptor all at once.
Yeah, creating a comprehensive functional map.
Exactly. So today, let's unpack how they did that, what they found, and what it could mean. But first, before we dive into the details, it's worth just pausing to acknowledge the scale of this project. Building a functional map like this for a complex receptor like INSR, that's no small feat.
No, absolutely not. It's a massive international effort we're discussing. So today we really celebrate the work of Vahidas Lanzada, Gemma V. Brierley, Robert K. Semple, Gregorios Kudla, and all their colleagues.
Right.
They're from institutions like the University of Edinburgh, Cambridge, the Paris Reference Centers for Insulin Resistance,
mm-hmm,
a big collaboration. And their work has genuinely pushed forward our understanding of how INSR gene changes relate to function,
huh,
and crucially, how we might use that information to better select therapies for patients. Okay, so to really get why this is so important, let's just quickly recap the insulin receptor's job.
Please do.
It's what we call a dimeric transmembrane receptor tyrosine kinase. Fancy name. But basically, it sits on the surface of almost all our cells. It's absolutely essential for life.
And its main job.
It's the gatekeeper for insulin's message. When insulin binds, the receptor tells the cell to take up glucose, store energy, and grow tissues. It's fundamental to metabolism.
And like we touched on earlier, when you have mutations in both copies of the INSR gene biallelic mutations, you get these severe syndromes, and they fall into categories based on that residual function.
Exactly. Donahue syndrome is at the extreme end, almost no function left, terrible prognosis. Then Rabson-Mendenhall, where there's some function, maybe 10, 20%, allowing longer survival.
And then there's another category.
Yes. There's also type A insulin resistance. This is often caused by mutations in just one copy of the gene, so it's dominant. These patients usually have, say, up to 25% function, maybe a bit more. And importantly, their condition is generally manageable with the therapies we currently have. And it's worth stressing, the clinical data suggests you need to lose quite a lot of function, more than half, probably before you start seeing these really severe clinical problems. The body has some built-in redundancy.
So the clinical picture seems pretty clear, tied directly to function, but that diagnostic bottleneck you mentioned, it's still a major issue.
Yeah.
We know over 150 mutations that definitely cause disease, but doctors keep finding new ones, these VUS.
Mm-hmm. And historically, the only way to figure out what a VUS actually did was to study it individually in the lab.
Which sounds slow.
painfully slow.
Yeah.
And expensive. And results could vary between labs. It just wasn't scalable for dealing with the constant discovery of new variants.
Right.
And this links back to the therapeutic potential we mentioned. We know even a small boost in signaling could be huge. So scientists have been interested in finding alternative ways to activate these broken receptors, maybe not with insulin, but with something else, like specifically designed antibodies.
Okay, like a key that fits a slightly damaged lock.
Kind of, yeah. Non-canonical agonists, but without knowing which specific mutant receptors might still be receptive to that kind of antibody activation. It's just shooting in the dark. You need the map first.
So if one by one testing is out, how do you test thousands? You said 14,000 variants all at the same time. What's the tech?
The technology is called multiplexed assays of variant effect, or MAVE. You might also hear it called deep mutational scanning, DMS. They're basically the same idea.
MAVE or DMS.
Got it. It allows you to create this enormous library containing all the variants you want to test. Then you put this library into cells, apply some kind of selection or sorting based on function, and then use deep sequencing to count which variants survived or performed well under specific conditions.
So instead of testing one bulb, you wire up the whole factory and see which lights turn on.
That's a great analogy, yeah. You get functional scores for thousands of variants in one go.
Okay, so how did they apply this MAV approach to the insulin receptor specifically?
They focused on the big outer part of the receptor, the extracellular domain. Residues, 28 to 955 of the B isoform, to be precise. This is where insulin binds.
Right.
Using a technique called saturation mutagenesis, they systematically created a library that included pretty much every possible single amino acid change across that entire region. That's how they got to roughly 14,000 different missense variants.
And where did they test these variants? In what kind of cells?
They needed a very clean system. So they used mouse embryo fibroblasts, MEFs. But these weren't just any mouse cells.
Specially engineered.
Exactly. They were engineered to lack the mouse equivalent of the insulin-like growth factor 1 receptor, IGF-1R, which can sometimes interfere with INSR signaling.
Mm-hmm.
And crucially, they also set it up so they could turn off the cell's own endogenous mouse insulin receptor using doxycycline.
Ah, so any signal they measured had to be coming from the human variant they introduced. No background noise.
Precisely. A clean slate to measure the function of each human INSR variant.
Okay, so they have the library of variants, they have the clean cell system. How did they actually measure function? You mentioned multiple assays.
Right, they didn't just ask one question. They used flow cytometry and cell sorting to score each variant on 5 different things.
5, okay.
One, just basic cell surface expression. Does the variant protein actually make it to the outside of the cell? They used 2 different antibodies that stick to INSR to measure this.
Okay, presence on the surface. What else?
2, insulin binding. Pretty straightforward, does insulin actually stick to this variant receptor? 3, binding of those specific monoclonal antibodies they use for the expression check. That tells you if those specific parts of the receptor are folded correctly.
Right. And the last 2 sound crucial.
Yeah.
Signaling.
Yes. 4, insulin-stimulated signaling. They added insulin and measured the downstream signal. And 5, monoclonal antibody-stimulated signaling. They use those same antibodies not just for detection, but to see if they could activate the receptor themselves.
And how did they measure signaling? What's the readout? You mentioned PEC-AT before.
Yeah, they measured the phosphorylation of a key downstream protein called AKT, so PEC-AT. When the receptor gets activated, it triggers a cascade inside the cell, and phosphorylating AKT is a critical step in that cascade.
So PEC-AT essentially means the on switch has been flipped, the message got through.
That's a perfect way to put it. Seeing PEC-AT tells you the receptor successfully received the signal, either insulin or the antibody, and relayed the command into the cell. No PEC-AT, no signal transmission.
Okay, this is where it gets really exciting. They've done this massive screen, gathered all this data. What did the map look like? Did it make sense?
It really did. The data set provided these quantitative function scores for nearly all the variants, creating this high-resolution map. And it immediately started telling a clear story.
How so?
Well, first, the clinical correlation was incredibly strong. When they compared the MAVE function scores to the known clinical severity of patients carrying those variants, it lined up almost perfectly. Variants found in Donahue syndrome, patients consistently had the lowest function scores in the MAVE assays. Rabson-Mendenhall variants had intermediate scores. And variants associated with the milder type A IR had the highest scores among the pathogenic ones.
So the lab scores directly reflected the real-world clinical spectrum. That's powerful validation.
Absolutely. It empirically confirmed the whole basis of how we categorize these syndromes by residual function.
What about structurally? Did the map highlight known important regions of the receptor?
Yes, it confirmed a lot of known structural biology. For example, mutations affecting specific cysteine residues in the cysteine-rich domains. These are known to be critical for proper folding and structure.
Jen.
And those mutations were, as expected, highly damaging in the MAVA assay, mostly because they severely reduced the receptor's expression on the cell surface. It just couldn't fold right to get out there.
Okay. What about the insulin binding site?
They saw clear clustering there, too. Mutations that primarily reduced insulin binding, but didn't affect expression as much, tended to cluster right in the alpha CT helix region. And that region is known to form a key part of what's called insulin binding, site 1.
Site 1. Is there more than one site?
Well, that's another interesting point. But sticking with site 1 for a second, they observed something consistent with this spare receptor concept.
Spare receptors, meaning you have more than you strictly need.
Exactly. For mutations affecting site 1, the negative impact on insulin binding was often much more severe than the impact on downstream signaling, the PACKEK measurement.
Huh. So you could lose, say, half your binding ability but still get almost full signaling.
Pretty much, yeah. It suggests the cell has this built-in buffer. You don't need to occupy every single receptor with insulin to get the maximum biological response.
Yeah.
Activating just a fraction is enough. It speaks to the system's robustness.
That makes sense. Okay, so what about this other site, site 2?
All right, so structural models suggest there might be a second lower affinity insulin binding site, site 2. But when they looked at mutations in the residues predicted to be part of site 2, they found those mutations had surprisingly mild effects, both on insulin binding and on signaling, at least in this experimental setup.
Why would that be? If it's a binding site, shouldn't messing it up have an effect?
The researchers suggest it might be down to the insulin concentration they used. They used a single high saturating concentration 100 nanomolar. At that high dose, the high affinity site 1 might be doing all the heavy lifting, making the contribution of a potential low affinity site 2 less critical or harder to detect.
Okay. So the assay conditions might have masked site 2's role. That's a potential limitation to maybe circle back to.
Definitely.
But let's talk about the VUS problem again. Did this map actually help resolve any of those uncertain variants?
Yes, and this is a really immediate translational benefit. They looked at variants listed in the ClinVar database, a major public resource that were classified as VUS for the INSR gene.
How many were there?
In their data set, there were 127 INSR variants designated as VUS in ClinVar at the time, and their MAVE data provided strong functional evidence against 31 of them.
31. So nearly a quarter of the VUS they tested.
That's right. These 31 variants showed a clear loss of function in at least one of their five assays, expression, binding, or signaling. This argues strongly that these shouldn't be VUS anymore. They should likely be reclassified as pathogenic or likely pathogenic.
That's huge for diagnostics. It means potentially dozens of families could get a clearer answer about the cause of their condition.
Exactly. Reducing that diagnostic uncertainty is a major step forward.
Okay, beyond sorting VUS, how well did the MAV scores perform overall at just predicting if a variant was bad or not, compared to, say, computational prediction tools?
The performance was outstanding, actually. When they calculated the ability of the MAVE scores to distinguish known disease-causing variants from benign ones, the predictive power was near perfect. The ROC-AUC, a measure of predictive accuracy, was above 0.96 for several of the assays.
Wow, 0.96 is incredibly high. How does that compare to the best computer algorithms, the variant effect predictors or VEPs, like AlphaMissense?
It's right up there, comparable to the very best VEPs currently available. So the empirical lab data is just as good as the best in silico predictions at simply saying harmful or not harmful.
I sense there's a but coming. If they're both that good, do they basically tell you the same thing?
Ah, that's the really interesting nuance. While both MAVE scores, the lab result, and VEP scores, a prediction, were excellent at the binary classification, harmful, benign, fear, the scores themselves only correlated moderately well with each other.
Moderately. What was the correlation?
With AlphaMissense, for instance, the correlation coefficient R was around 0.53.
Okay, 0.53. That's not terrible, but it's definitely not 1.0. Why is that moderate correlation so significant? They both predict pathogenicity well, but they don't seem to agree perfectly on the level of damage.
Precisely. And it matters because it highlights why you really need both approaches. The computational VEPs are fantastic. They leverage evolutionary conservation, protein structure predictions, AI.
Yeah.
They predict the likelihood that a variant disrupts the protein.
Right.
But the MAVE provides the empirical evidence, the actual biochemical measurement of what that variant does to expression, binding, signaling in a relevant cell system. They're capturing different facets of the variant's effect.
So the computer makes a very educated guess, but the MAVE assay is the ground truth, the biological reality check.
That's a good way to think about it. The moderate correlation suggests the computational tools are missing some biological subtleties that the functional assay picks up, and maybe vice versa sometimes too. You really want both the prediction and the functional validation for the clearest picture.
Okay, that makes sense. The methodology is impressive. The diagnostic potential is clear. But let's get back to that initial promise, finding therapies. Did this map identify variants that might be treatable in new ways?
Yes, this is arguably the most exciting translational outcome. Remember, they tested signaling not just with insulin, but also with monoclonal antibodies.
Mm-hmm. Antibodies 83.7 and 83.14.
Exactly. They specifically looked for variants that didn't respond well to insulin, showing low PKT signal with insulin stimulation, but did show a relatively better response when stimulated with one or both of those antibodies.
And did they find any?
They found a lot. Specifically, 11,193 missense variants fit this profile. Variants that were functionally impaired in response to insulin, but showed comparatively better signaling activation by the antibodies.
1,193 variants. That seems like a huge number.
It is. It represents a significant pool of specific genetic defects that might be amenable to antibody-based therapy, even when standard insulin therapy wouldn't be very effective because the receptor just doesn't respond well to it anymore.
So for a patient with one of these specific mutations, you could potentially bypass the defective insulin response and activate the receptor using a different approach.
That's the hope. These 11,193 variants are now prime candidates for follow-up studies, potentially using humanized versions of these antibodies as therapeutic agents.
Ah.
It opens the door to stratifying patients based on the specific functional defect of their INSR variant.
Which leads to that crucial question.
Can we choose a therapy tailored not just to the general disease category, but to the precise way that patient's receptor is broken? That's the essence of precision medicine for these devastating syndromes.
It's incredibly promising. But as with any major study, we should also look at the limitations. What did the authors point out as areas for future work?
They highlighted a couple of main things. First, as we touched on briefly, they used only that single high concentration of insulin.
Right, which might have missed the role of site 2.
Exactly. And more generally, it means they couldn't capture potentially important differences in the sensitivity to insulin shifts in the dose response curve. Some mutations might not affect the maximum signal, but might require much more insulin to achieve it. That's clinically relevant, but this assay wouldn't see it.
Okay, so dose response is one thing. What else?
The other key limitation relates to the dynamics of the receptor. MAVE assays, like this one, typically provide a snapshot of function at a specific time point. They're less suited to capturing defects in dynamic processes that happen over time.
Like what kind of processes?
Receptor recycling is a big one. After the receptor binds insulin and signals, it gets internalized into the cell. Normally, it then gets recycled back to the surface to signal again. Some known pathogenic mutations mess up this recycling process.
And the MAV assay didn't pick those up.
Correct. They specifically noted a couple of known pathogenic variants, I146M and K487E, which actually looked normal in their MAV assays for expression, binding, and maximal signaling. But the reason these variants cause disease is thought to be due to impaired receptor recycling, a defect the specific MAV setup couldn't measure.
So does that imply a fundamental limit for MAV technology when you're studying things like recycling?
For this type of MAVE, yes. It gives you a powerful snapshot of steady-state function, or maximum response, but it doesn't easily capture the kinetics or the dynamics over time.
Yeah.
So the clear next step is to adapt. They need to take this amazing variant library they've built and apply assays that can measure dose-response relationships and potentially track receptor trafficking and recycling over time. That would give an even more comprehensive functional map. So, wrapping up the main findings. This deep mutational scanning approach delivered a truly remarkable sequence function map for the insulin receptor's extracellular domain. It covers nearly every possible single amino acid change.
And that map isn't just academically interesting. It has immediate practical value.
Absolutely. Dual utility, really. First, diagnostically, it helps resolve a significant chunk of the VUS problem for the INSR gene, providing clearer answers for patients.
And second, maybe even more excitingly for the future.
Translationally, it identifies over 1,000 specific loss-of-function mutations, those 1190,093 variants that seem poorly responsive to insulin but are potentially activatable by specific antibodies. These are now the top targets for developing next-generation precision therapies.
It really makes you think, doesn't it? What does this truly mean for the future of treating severe insulin resistance? Are we moving past just giving more and more insulin towards therapies that are precisely targeted to the specific way an individual patient's receptor is malfunctioning?
I think that's exactly where this points. For these rare but devastating conditions, this work brings us a significant step closer to offering truly personalized, potentially life-altering treatments based directly on the patient's unique genetic defect.
This deep dive was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.